Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Nina Tumark, and I direct Russian Area Studies, the Russian Area Studies program here. And our program is proud to present, ta-da, Professor Marshall Goldman, who, is it fair to say you started to teach here almost a half century ago? Pretty close. He's been an institution at this institution, the only person I know who's had two name chairs, class of 1919, professor of economics, and then Catherine W. Davis, professor of economics. Marshall Goldman has been an enormously loyal member of the Wellesley community. He taught here for decades, and then even after he retired, he still taught here, and has continued to travel with alumni, to speak to alumni groups, to raise money, to just be a presence. He comes once a year to the annual early September panel of Russian Area Studies faculty, the current state of the former Soviet Union, and he's the author of a gazillion books, the latest of which is actually Everything's Peas, right? The Piratization of Russia, and so many other books. He's an economist who also has been for many years first a Soviet watcher, and then a Russia watcher, and also a watcher of non-Russian areas that are extremely important. It's an enormous privilege, pleasure. It's with privilege, okay, I'll do the P's, Marsh. It's with privilege, pleasure, and pride that I introduce Professor Marshall Goldman to give us a talk entitled Putin Power, Petroleum, Power, and Patronage. The dog barks, but the caravan moves on. When I invited him to give a talk, he said he would, and I asked him a little while later, what's the title? And he said, The Dog Barks, But the Caravan Moves On. And I said, that's wonderful. Everybody's going to know just what the talk is about. So he was kind enough to actually prefix it with a few very choice words. Well, we're delighted to have Marshall here and look forward to what he has to say this evening. Marshall.
I have. Too well. Well, I'm going to put it in my pocket and hide it, see if that'll make a difference. Anyway, when you say I was watching Everything, I had thought for a while you were talking about me as a peeping Tom. I didn't want to. Anyway, thank you very much, Nina. I hope everybody has a handout, because if you don't, there are a few left down here. Well, this is going to be a look at Putin. It's going to be a look at the United States. And what I'm going to end up arguing is that Russia is in a stronger position now than it's been since the Tsarist era, which is a pretty far-reaching conclusion. But in the meantime, the American-Russian relationship has deteriorated. Bush and Putin still hug each other when they meet. But the honeymoon is really over. And there are some very serious, implications to that. The United States is looking more and more critically at what Russia is doing, and Russia is looking more and more critically at what we're doing. The Council on Foreign Relations just issued a report, very critical of what Russia was doing, saying basically that we should take a much harder stance, questioning but not suggesting that perhaps the United States should demand that Russia be thrown out of the G8, which is just about to enter. The G8, of course, is the leading, up until now, the seven leading democratic, richer countries, the developed countries in the world. The U.S. President's office, Bush's office, has just issued a statement being almost equally critical. The United States, from Putin's point of view, is the one barrier preventing Russia from joining the World Trade Organization. Putin just gave a press conference in which he singled out the United States as the biggest obstacle for Russia doing that. Putin said, do we meet their demands? then they issue new demands, and it's as if they just don't want us in there. Senator McCain and Congressman Lantos have both insisted that Russia not be allowed to take over the chairmanship of the G8, which Putin will do this July in St. Petersburg. And then to top everything else off, Putin has been saying that the focus of his chairmanship of the G8 will be how reliable Russia is as a supplier of energy. And then I presume most of you are aware of the fact that in January, Russia cut the flow of natural gas to Ukraine, which in turn cut the flow of natural gas to Europe. January is, if you're going to cut off the natural flow of natural gas, you cut it off in January when it's cold. And the Europeans really were brought up short by that after the Russians had insisted, even before this, that they could be counted on to improve things. Well, so much of this has been brought to a head by some other events that took place. For example, the seizure of Yukos, Russia's largest, richest oil company, and the jailing its CEO, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's been put in jail for 8 years. Some of my friends in Washington tell me that when that happened, for the first time, President Bush really became skeptical of this very warm relationship that he's developed with Putin. Since then, of course, also the Russians have seized control of all the independent television networks. So Putin now and the government now has control of the major media. They haven't controlled all the newspapers, but many of the newspapers are feeling intimidated. Putin has basically eliminated the democratic parties that we would support, those who are looking to the West, the SPS and the Yabloko party, because they have to have a 7% vote standing in the Duma, and neither one got it. So the parties that are running now really don't espouse what we would hope would be the democratic ideal. Putin's party is certainly not doing that. There's also beginning to harass NGOs, non-governmental organizations. They're now requiring that everybody who's not affiliated with the government register, that those NGOs, particularly those focusing on human rights, must have permission. If they've gotten money from the West, if they're getting money from the Ford Foundation, they've got to account for that. And then again, this cutoff of natural gas. So what I want to try to do this evening, I'm going to begin with the gas crisis, because I think that sets signals, which I don't think we fully appreciated in January, and I'm not sure the Russians fully appreciate it now, just how much things have changed and how much it means to us. Then why did Russia do this to Ukraine? And why, after a decade of economic and political chaos under Yeltsin, and before that even Gorbachev, why is Putin doing what he's doing now? And how does this relate to the United States and Western Europe? Okay, so let me then begin, first of all, with what happened in Ukraine. This was big news at the time, and indeed it played a very important role. And I say what was to follow. You all have a map on the back, since you're not going to see this all that well. But what happened is you have to go back to the Soviet period when it was all one big country, happy or unhappy, there it was together. No one anticipated that they would be broken up into 15 independent countries. And so the pipelines, which you see here, this is the pipeline network for natural gas, was coming in from Siberia, as it were, although Ukraine itself was an early producer of natural gas, and indeed at one point was the richest producer in the country. So it was coming from all different directions. It's like spaghetti. But what I want you to focus on, to give you the idea of how no one ever thought that there would be independent countries, this particular pipeline, the one furthest to the east, you see, comes north from the north, but then it comes south. Now, if you look at the second map, you'll see what happens there. It comes to the very eastern part of Ukraine, and so it's coming down, and you see it comes and it cuts this little piece here. Then it goes into Russia again. So what happened is, when they cut off the flow of gas, they cut it off not only to Ukraine, but they also cut it off to Russia itself. I mean, just how bizarre this whole process was. Now, also dating back to the Soviet period, what you had happening was that energy was cheap. This was an intentional goal of the Soviet planners. The idea is if raw materials were cheap, this would make it easy to produce an attractive and even profitable to produce heavy industrial products. And the Russians were very much interested in producing machine tools, heavy industry. They wanted to build up their heavy industry with the idea that this would make them a strong military power, a strong industrial power. The Russians, indeed, even under Gorbachev, seemed to have a fetish with heavy machine tools. Machine tool, you know, Gorbachev is going to do things differently. He comes along, he's going to do the same thing, as it were. And you begin to think about it, this fetish they have with machine tools, it almost seemed as if machine tools did for the Politburo what sex does for most of us, and the bigger the machine tools, the more satisfying it was. And so they built these massive things that were very heavily dependent on energy and would not have been produced if energy had been expensive. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, the legacy of the Soviet Union was this machine tool industry, particularly strong in Ukraine, where there were very important deposits of iron ore and coal, and the steel industry built up in a very big way. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, you had an industry that was very heavily dependent on cheap energy. And so when the gas flow was cut off this January, this jeopardized the whole industrial structure of Ukraine. They've come to recognize this now, but in the meantime, the implications of higher energy costs, no matter what, how high it goes, it's going to really hurt that industrial sector. And so that's why the Ukrainians were so nervous, and that's why, indeed, as we'll see, the recent election that took place in Ukraine, the president at the time, a man by the name of Yushchenko, his party came in third, even though he was our hero. He looked like a big democratic innovator. Because it's really threatened the economy of the country. Okay, now, so in the post-Soviet period, what is happening? Well, if you look at Table 1, you can see that it may show up better here because that doesn't reproduce too well on a copying machine. But you can see the old agreement. Ukraine, as I said, was a producer of natural gas itself. And the largest supplier of natural gas to Ukraine actually came from Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan being part of Central Asia, which again was part of the Soviet Union, but now is an independent country. So most of it came from Turkmenistan, but it all came through a pipeline which was monopolized by Gazprom, the state energy producer, the monopolist, as it were. So this... And Turkmenistan was not allowed to charge all that much because the Russians held down the price so very significantly. Now, what was going on? Why was this cut off? Why did this cut off take place? Well, the man that I just mentioned, Yushchenko, the president, when he got into office, declared that Ukraine should look more to the West. And he had an American wife, which also gave the Russians some concerns, because this reflected his pro-Western position. And this was clearly something that the Russians didn't like. Ukraine is a Slavic nation, and what the Russians wanted was the Slavs to unite together. Belarus is the other Slavic country, and there was a portion of Kazakhstan, which is, even though it was Central Asia, there. The Russians had moved in there during the Virgin Lands period under Khrushchev. And the Russians were hoping that this group would come together and really be the core of what used to be the Soviet Union. But Yushchenko was going to make that very difficult. This is name-dropping, but my wife's not here, so I can do that. In September 2004, I was with a small group that met with President Putin in what was called the Valdai Hills Discussion Group. And this was before now Yushchenko was elected president. The question came up, and Putin was asked, well, what would Russia do if Ukraine looked more to the West? Because already there were hints that that might happen. And Putin said this, well, that's fine. We won't do anything to oppose them. But they should understand if they do that, you people from the West will have to pick up the burden that we've been bearing up until now. By that he meant you're going to have to pick up the subsidy. And the United States has been giving Ukraine a subsidy annually of about a little bit less than $200 million a year. And he said, well, okay, that's going to be your burden, but you should also understand, and the Ukrainians should understand, that we will stop subsidizing them, because what was happening is that Russia was charging the West Europeans for Russian natural gas $230 per 1,000 cubic meters. The price to Ukraine was only $50, so $230 versus $50, which means, given what Ukraine was consuming, that the Russians were providing Ukraine with a subsidy of over $3 billion a year. $3 billion now. The United States was only providing about $200 million. So you should understand that. The Ukrainians should understand that. So he signaled that, indeed, if there was going to be trouble, this is what he was going to do. He went on to say, what was wrong with having a strong state-owned energy conglomerate? Because Gazprom turns out to be Russia's largest industry. It's a monopoly. It contains the world. It controls the world's largest deposits of natural gas. As we'll see in a second, it supplies Western Europe with about 30% of its natural gas, and it supplies Germany with 40% of its natural gas. So it's an immense corporation, and it's owned by the state. It's state-owned. More than 50% of the stock is controlled by the state. He says, what's wrong with that? You may not like it in the United States, but the United States is one of the few countries in the world where the energy industries companies are not owned by the state. So if we do this, this is exactly what the Netherlands, Norway is doing. That's what, of course, the OPEC countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait are doing. So what's wrong with that? Not this year, but 2005. Again, there was another meeting of the same group in September. And this time, Putin said, what's wrong with using energy as a foreign policy instrument? So now Yushchenko's been elected as president, and there indeed is now this indication that we'll hit them, and we will use this to try to gain whatever political aims we may have. Now, it's interesting. I just read this afternoon that the Minister of Foreign Affairs said Russia does not use its economic weapons as political weapons, contradicting, of course, what Putin said, because to say that what Putin said there candidly is really a threatening thing to the West Europeans, who are being told they should rely more on Russia as a supplier of energy. Because if you're going to use it as a political weapon, that means that you may be held up for blackmail. Anyway, Putin signaled clearly at the time this is what he was going to do, and comes January 2006, that's exactly what he did do. Why did he do it? Well, one, to show the Ukrainians a lesson, one, to intimidate them, and I think in part he thought that the West Europeans would blame Ukraine if Ukraine failed to send the natural gas that Russia was providing it on to Western Europe. What happened is that Putin, Gazprom, cut back the flow of natural gas to Ukraine so that only the gas that Western Europe was entitled to would go through. But the Ukrainians, of course, took it for themselves. Why did they cut off the flow of gas? Because Russia said, we want you to pay $230 per 1,000 cubic meters. The Ukrainians were paying, again, only $50, just like like they were doing prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So the Putin was saying, pay up. The Ukrainian says, we can't do it. We've got a contract. We don't have to do it. So the Russians said, we're going to cut the flow of gas. They cut the flow of gas, and the Ukrainians simply took what was going through, supposed to go through to Europe. Putin thought that when the Ukrainians did that, anticipating they would do that, that the West Europeans would say, you're stealing our gas. And this would embarrass Ukraine and make them less desirable as a candidate to join the European Union, which is what Yushchenko was hoping ultimately to bring about. So that by pulling these various tricks, he thought this would humiliate and embarrass the Ukrainians. They'd fall into the trap, and this would be bad. Instead, what happened is the West Europeans and the West generally said, the Russians are freezing the poor Ukrainians, And look how unreliable they are. So that, it kind of backfired. Okay, well, so why did the gas cutoff matter? Why did Putin feel so confident to do it at that point? And how does this fit in with what's going on elsewhere? Okay, so now I'm going to go back just a little bit to give you some background about this new feeling. Look at table 2. There's more here than you need to know, but it's quite revealing. I'm going to use this as a surrogate to kind of give you a survey of how of what has happened to Russia in a very since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Look at total oil production. The GDP, as and in part similarly with oil production, hit a high point, as it were, 1980, 1985, 442. By 1990, petroleum production reached 516 million tons. That's about a little bit more than 10 million barrels a day. 50 million tons equal about a barrel a day. Okay, then look what happened. From 1990 to 1995, it fell. It kept falling. It hit a low point in 1996. 1998 was 2003. Then it began to pick up again. Gas production did not suffer as much, but that's a drop of about 40%. The GDP dropped from 1990 to 1998 by about 40%. A real collapse. This is under Yeltsin. This is a very serious deterioration in what happened. So economically, the country, Russia, was suffering a depression that was greater than what the United States suffered in the 1930s. A 40% collapse, some say 50% collapse of the economy. Politically, you had a similar collapse take place. Yeltsin, who was the president after 1991 of what remained of Russia, it was enfeebled. He had bad kidneys. He had a bad heart. He had heart attacks. He was drunk a good portion of the time. Also, he was suffering from mental breakdowns a good portion of the time. He acknowledged this in a autobiography that he wrote while he was president. Usually you don't acknowledge you have mental breakdowns until you're out of office. He acknowledged that he was having them when he was in office. And so the country was just really deteriorating. He was not doing anything to stop power from being taken in the provinces. The provinces were seizing power for themselves. They were threatening to secede from Russia. This was in addition to the breakup of the Soviet Union when the other 14 republics spun off, so it looked like it was going to happen again. And there were also, you know, corruption was rampant. Corruption in the White House, the Russian White House, was rampant. His daughters were accused of taking millions of dollars of kickbacks, tens of millions of dollars of kickbacks from contractors from Switzerland that were remodeling the Kremlin, remodeling the Russian White House, building Yeltsin's yacht. I've been on Yeltsin's yacht. It's a nice yacht. It's all very nice. So this was, it was notorious for this. A man drives his car into the Kremlin, gets out. A policeman runs over to him. You can't park there. That's right underneath Yeltsin's office. Don't worry. I locked the car. Well, you know, it was just this notion that you couldn't trust anybody in this. And the general environment of corruption pervaded the whole economic system. This was the growth of the oligarchs, the people who were billionaires. At one point, Russia had more billionaires than anybody but the United States. Moscow, in fact, had more than New York City. The number, Russia has fallen back now behind Germany because after they arrested all the Yukos people and took away their money, they fell a little bit below. But they're still in third place. Just an amazing thing, given the fact that in 1990, until 1990, almost none of these people had any net worth at all. So that you can see how quickly it all took place. A Mexican and an Egyptian and a Russian were driving their car through Russia, and after a while the Mexican points to this factory that he sees. He says, "See that textile plant?" He says, "My company built that." He says, "I got a kickback of $50 million. So they drive a little further, the Egyptian comes, he says, "See that dam?" He says, "My company built that. I got a kickback of $75 million. They go a little further, the Russian says, "See that petrochemical plant? My company built that. I got a kickback of $100 million. The Mexican and the Egyptian look around. What petrochemical plant? You have to think about that. Well, anyway, but that was the atmosphere that existed. And, of course, the mafia also grew at this point. And they used the word the mafia. The only similarity was that they saw the movie The Godfather, and they really imitated exactly what they thought the mafia should do in terms of the dress, in terms of the way they behaved. And at one point, 70% of the Russian economy was controlled or paid off, was extorted by the mafia. It was that high at one point. They would become partners. They would threaten. They'd come into a firm and say, you need a partner, and they would basically take it over. So they tell the story of little Ivan, who was being forced to take violin lessons by his parents, who were mafia. His father was a member of the mafia. And the teacher knew that Ivan was not happy about this. So anyway, one day Ivan comes to class and by mistake drops his violin case, and out pops a machine gun. So the teacher is a bit nervous about that. He says, Ivan, what do you plan to do with that machine gun? And Ivan says, a better question is, what does my father plan to do with my violin? Well, it was that kind of environment. Anyway, the economy begins to recover. So going back to this, you see what begins to happen in 1998. 1998 is a financial crisis. August 17th, the economy implodes. They default on their debt. The stock market, Russian stock market, crashes. But it also happens that in 1998, the price of oil, the price of energy, begins to increase. And the price of oil, which in 1997, 1998, was $10 a barrel, begins to rise to $20, $30, and ultimately, of course, $60, and today, $69 a barrel. And you can see what then begins to happen. The oil production begins to rise so that it's by last year it was up to 470 million tons, just short of 10 million barrels a day. Not back quite where it was in the late 80s, but on the way there. And this, of course, brings an enormous windfall to Russia. Since the year 2000, 40% of the increase in the world's oil production has come from Russia, which is, of course, it dropped before, but this is recovery, taking advantage of. That's what's feeding our increased energy consumption. That's what's feeding China. That's what's feeding India. And it's not just that oil production is increasing, but GDP has been increasing at the rate of 6 to 7% a year. And it brings an enormous cash windfall. Oil earnings in 1998 were $14 billion, export earnings for Russia. 1998, I take it as the low point. 2004, they rose to $58 billion, from $14 to $58 billion. And 2005, I don't have the exact figure, but it's close to $70. And it may be approaching $100 billion. So what does that mean? That means that Russia's been able to prepay its debt to the Paris, the Club of Paris, which are mainly West European creditors. It's prepaid its debt to the IMF. It's been just rolling in money this way. They build up. They now have about the world's fourth or fifth largest reserves in the world, after China, Japan, maybe Germany, and then Russia. Last year, the United States imported oil from Russia worth about, not quite, $8 billion, whereas we never did anything like that before. In the Soviet period, they were buying grain from us. They're not buying. Now the Russians have a very large trade surplus with the United States, largely because of this oil. Now, if you look at this growth that takes place, it precedes, as it were, Putin's coming to power. Putin is made the prime minister in August 1999. He becomes president in March of the year 2000. So this recovery, as it were, is not due to Putin. But he does make a difference. Why does he make a difference? Well, first of all, he's not an alcoholic. Second of all, he's not as prone to heart attacks. In fact, he's much younger. Karate, jiu-jitsu, all of these things. And he's become a cult figure. For those who remember John Kennedy, just as John Kennedy was a young symbol of youth and vigor, and his picture would appear everywhere. You will find the same kind of thing with Putin as a cult figure in many ways. And he halted politically the decentralized drift that was taking place, the centrifugal force. He's restored the center. He's talking about restoring Russia as a superpower, doing all these things. And he's also said that the GDP he wants to have doubled in 10 years' time. And if you grow at a rate of 7% a year through compound interest, that's what you can do in 10 years' time. But even so, there are still some questions about his initial legitimacy. When he ran for president in March 2000, I happened to be a poll watcher then at the time, and in the evening we went to the election central headquarters, and the results coming in showed that Putin was not getting the 50% of the vote that he needed to avoid a runoff. It was something like 47-48%. And I saw one of my friends who was a television commentator, and I said, it looks like Putin's not going to do it. He said, don't worry. He said, before the evening is over, he'll have his 50% of the vote, and sure enough, he did. So again, they tell the story about how Putin got a phone call from the head of the elections central committee, the man supervising the election. He says, Mr. Putin, he says, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news for you. So Putin says, well, give me the bad news first. He says, well, your opponent, Zhuganov, the head of the Communist Party, got 70% of the vote. So Putin says, well, how can there be any good news? He says, well, you got 80%. So in a sense, that's where it was. He understands Russia's craving for stability. There's something that the Russian people, after all, that tumult crave. In this meeting in September 2005, he repeated all the time that what the Russian people want is stability. He was asked if he was going to run again for president. There are term limits in Russia. His term expires in 2008, and he's by the Constitution, he's not entitled to run again. He said, no, I'm not going to run again. He says, because for me to run again, there would have to be a constitutional amendment that would be destabilizing. Now, you know, who knows what will happen between now and 2008. There could be a groundswell of people marching, saying we need Putin. But the way he said it, it seemed to me reflected, I think, a legitimate and a sincere concern on his part to reverse himself after all this insistence, I think, would really be destabilizing. But to watch what's been happening with him is, I think, quite demoralizing. We were very excited after the Gorbachev, early Yeltsin years, when they really were embracing democracy, when there was freedom of the press. It's not that freedom of press is dead just yet, but one after another, the newspapers are really self-censoring themselves. And I say television is all fully controlled. You know, what happened is that we thought Russia had, as a pendulum swings, was kind of coming down finally to the bottom, and that was going to be democracy. And in our country, you know, we shift from right to left periodically, McCarthy period, the Vietnamese period, but so far, at least, we've always come back to the central position where a democracy was important. Well, what happened is that period of Gorbachev and Yeltsin was not at the bottom, but it was really unsustainable because the pendulum swung and that period of democracy really was abnormal. And it seems to me the Russian people prefer this kind of thing, which is a strong statement to make. And if there are Russians in the audience, I suspect you'll take issue with it because in the past, whenever I say it, that's always the response. But unfortunately, that seems to be the case. I said the Democratic parties have been basically wiped out. Television is controlled. They're going after the NGOs, to repeat what I said before. They cannot understand why there are these groups that are advocating human rights, that are advocating more democratic participation, should be funded by the Ford Foundation, by the MacArthur Foundation, by the National Endowment for Democracy, which is an American-funded, American government-funded organization. They say, why don't you spend money Why doesn't the Ford Foundation spend money at home? I was in Florida last night, and so why don't you could ask the question, why doesn't the Ford Foundation try to do something to improve voting in Florida? You know, where we've had some problems in the past. So they're unable to understand why such foundation would be so self-sacrificing. So there is this question. And on top of that, it's not only that they're taking away these political controls, but they're beginning a process of renationalization. And for an economist, that also is unfortunate. If you look at table 4, what you see happening here is that one after another, they're beginning to go out after the richest companies and take them back under the state control. Privatization was widespread in the beginning of 1993, 94, 95, 96. Now, in a sense, to get rid of the oligarchs, in the process of getting rid of the oligarchs, they're going back and taking over some of the richest companies. Ugand's Neftogaz was part of Yukos. That's Khodorkovsky's company. It's now under the control of Rosneft. Rosneft has been wholly state-owned, although they're now going to sell some shares of stock publicly. Sibneft Oil has now been taken up by Gazprom just in the last several months. Gazprom, I say 51% of Gazprom was owned by the state, but it's a state company for all intents and purposes. They've just announced they're taking over the largest automobile company, putting it under the control of Ross Oberon Export, which is their main exporter of military equipment, of arms. They're gradually indeed taking over a lot of these automobile plants. They've just combined all the aircraft industries and put them under what is called United Aircraft. That's not the company that we know in this country. And of course, some of these companies were controlled before, but again, the pendulum is swinging in a different direction where they're taking these companies over. They're arguing these resources belong to the state. Again, remember what Putin said, what's wrong with having a state-owned energy company? This allows them to throw out the oligarchs who were upstarts. Many of the oligarchs who were there, the people who were on the top of the Forbes list of the richest people in the world, were nothing before. They were traders, they were black market dealers. Why should these people end up with the control of Russia's richest resources? And it responds to the demand for revenge that so many Russians felt. Now, on top of that, the people taking it over are also very interesting. This is table 5. What is happening is that these people are called Siloviki, the law and order types, the power, the strength. And who are these people? Well, they were the people who belonged to the KGB. Some of them were Putin's comrades in the KGB. Some were in the military. Take Sechin, for example. He was a member of the KGB. He is the chairman of Rosneft. That's the state-owned company that took over Yukos. But what is particularly interesting is that his day job is a deputy chief of staff of the Kremlin staff. You go to Medvedev, who was not a member of the KGB, but was Putin's buddy from St. Petersburg. He's the chairman of Gazprom. He's the head of, his day job is the chief of staff of the Kremlin. So, you know, if you look at what these people are, who they were, what they're doing, in a sense, it's patronage. He's rewarding his buddies that he feels that he can trust, but he's putting them in charge of these companies. This past September, my question to Putin was, it looks like you're creating a new class of oligarchs. You've gotten rid of Khodorkovsky, but now you're creating these new people. Don't you think that these people will end up being a new group of oligarchs? And he said, no. He says they don't get any salaries, they don't get any honoraria, but somebody has to vote the state stock. Well, I will tell you, I would bet you anything that in 5 years' time, they will start appearing on the Forbes list of the richest as well. And they were in control. The state was in control during the Tsarist era. They were controlled in the Soviet era, the KGB types, and they're now coming back this way. So it's a new form of oligarchy. It's a new form of patronage, and indeed that is quite threatening to the productivity of the state because these companies have always tended to be abusive. We can expect a loss of efficiency and more corruption than we have before. And if you talk to Russians today, they will tell you that in the last 2 years of Putin's regime, that corruption is more rampant than ever, which was not supposed to happen because Putin was supposed to come in and clean things up. Now, there's also a problem that these people are worried and are jockeying for position as to who will succeed Putin. Because if something should happen, if Putin doesn't run, then a new person may come in, and that new person may say, this is just too much incest, too much nepotism, and we've got to change it, and these people will lose their positions, which, of course, could mean lots of wealth and lots of power for them. Some have speculated that when Putin retires or leaves office, he will become the chairman of Gazprom. Again, Russia's richest company. Putin was asked that question at another press conference on July 31st, and he said, no, I won't. I'm a politician. I'm not a businessman. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. But even the very fact that the question could be asked is intriguing. Okay, well, what's the impact of this on the outside? Well, Putin says, rely on us. We're dependable. And to some extent, this is an incredible argument that he's making. If you look at tables 6, 7, and 8, they're all here together now. Russia is the next largest supplier of natural gas to Europe, except for Norway, the Netherlands, and Great Britain. The North Sea, that's the West Europeans. The deposits there are beginning to be depleted. So Russia is a very important source, totally, in what's going on. And if you look at specific cases at natural gas, if you look at Table 7, say, look at Germany. I mentioned before, 40% of Germany's imports of natural gas come from Russia. Italy, 32%. Even France, 30%. And, of course, you get down to Eastern Europe and Finland, and you get 100% dependency. Now, the significance of this is that, particularly with natural gas, once you're hooked up to the natural gas pipeline, you are at the mercy of the supplier of natural gas. The reason for that is that, unlike oil, where you can bring it by tanker, or you can bring it by railroad car, or you can bring it by truck, the gas pipeline requires a very large fixed cost. Billions of dollars, 10, 12, maybe $20 billion to build a pipeline, particularly if you're bringing it from a long distance. And you cannot afford, given that fixed cost, to have a standby pipeline. You can't, it would not be feasible. So if for some reason that there should be a blockage of that flow in the pipeline, you don't have many alternatives. It is possible, if you've been following Boston politics, that you can liquefy natural gas, ship it by these special tankers. We do that in Everett here. And recently, if you follow Boston politics, nobody wants to have it in their backyard because if a terrorist gets a hold of it, or even if a terrorist doesn't get a hold of it, somebody else does, it could blow up the whole city. And you would rather not have it occur next door to you. But the point is that you can then still have this. That's a possible alternative. But even that's expensive because you've got to, first of all, freeze it. That's expensive. Then you've got to build these special tankers. That's expensive. Then you've got to warm it up, and that's expensive. So that whole operation is a very expensive operation. But the point is that once you're dependent here on this natural gas, you really are at the mercy of the supplier. And Gerhard Schroeder, who was the chancellor of West Germany and who was close buddy of Putin, argued strongly that Germany should become dependent on Russia, because it's a reliable supplier. And if we rely on natural gas from Russia, first of all, it's cleaner environmentally, but they will supply it regularly. And if we do that, we can do away with our nuclear energy, which, of course, has always been a subject of deep environmental concern. So Schroeder, while he was chancellor, began a policy of closing down the nuclear facilities, which, of course, meant that then they would really be dependent on Russia for their sources of supply. So this was a conscious policy. Also, of course, to the extent that you rely on Russia, you don't have to rely on the Middle East. So in some sense, he's right. You know, this, you spread your risks this way. The embarrassing thing is, however, that once Schroeder was out of office and Angela Merkel now has taken his place, it's announced that, that Schroeder will become the chairman of a joint Russian-German committee, stockholders committee, which will build a pipeline from Russia through the Baltic Sea into Germany, bypassing Ukraine so the Ukrainians can't cut it off, bypassing Poland so the Poles can't cut it off, bypassing Belarus because they can't cut it off. And on top of that, his salary is going to be 200,000 euros, which means he's going to be getting about $250,000-$260,000 salary a year for being chairman of this. In a sense, he's being bought off in this kind of thing. But in the aftermath of what took place, it did generate a lot of concern. And the fact that, it's a wake-up call. In my mind, Putin moved too quickly. Oh, I forgot one thing. I forgot to show you oil. It's not just natural gas, but it's also the Europeans are also becoming dependent on Russian petroleum. This FSU stands for former Soviet Union, so some of this comes also from Kazakhstan, but the bulk of it comes from Russia. Again, go to Germany. 42% of Germany's oil now comes from Russia. And you can see, Finland doesn't count all that much, or Eastern Europe, but Belgium, 40%, the Netherlands, 30%. So that you can see for both oil and gas. Although, again, there are other alternatives with oil, but still, it's very, Russia has become the Saudi Arabia of Europe. It's as simple as that. Okay, now there was this awareness that I was talking about. There was an editorial in the Financial Times called "Your Local Gazprom" in the wake of this, complaining and warning that Gazprom was attempting to buy up Great Britain's major supplier of natural gas. And what they're saying, we can't let them do that because this will just add to the monopoly. Ukraine is under pressure. That was one of the other reasons why the embargo was imposed, because Russia wants to take over control of the pipeline going, those pipelines that I showed you in the beginning. Same thing with Belarus. They just announced after the election in Belarus that the price of gas to Belarus is also going to go up unless the Belarusians sell control or give control of the pipeline going through Belarus, which supplies 20% of the gas going to Western Europe, to Russia. So they want that control. They've just reached an agreement with Armenia to take control of the gas pipeline going through Armenia, which means that Iran, which ships its gas through Armenia now, will have to go through Russian pipelines. They put similar pressure on Georgia. And so the Financial Times is saying, do we want to become an appendage of this kind of thing, because we'll be caught up this way and it will hurt us. I think Putin was aware of the fact that he acted prematurely. It would have been much easier if all these things had come firmly under the control of Gazprom so that they couldn't question it. They were really be trapped. So there was this odd thing that Putin wrote an op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal. What a strange combination. Saying that we're reliable, that indeed that's what we're going to talk about when we get to the G8 in St. Petersburg. Then they put a big ad in the New York Times saying exactly the kind of thing, and that we need energy cooperation. And of course, President Bush has also been saying we've got to have cooperation between Germany, between the United States and Russia. Well, what are the alternatives? Well, there aren't many. And adding to this concentration, Putin just went to China. And while he was in China, he announced that he was going to build two pipelines, natural gas pipelines, to China. One we had anticipated, that was going to come from East Siberia, which, furthest away from Europe. But he also said we're going to build a second pipeline that's going to come from West Siberia. And this really upset the Europeans, because they had anticipated that's where they were going to get their gas from. And when this other pipeline is built to China, then Putin can say to the West Europeans, look, you pay my price, or I send it off to China. And he can tell the Chinese, you pay my price, or I send it off to Europe. Again, a very skillful type of negotiation. Well, there's one other alternative, and that's nuclear, and there's a table in there which shows you how dependence or how little nuclear energy plays in Europe. The country that's most dependent on nuclear energy, of course, is France, which gets 78% of its electrical generation from nuclear energy. Germany is much less, and again, I say they were attempting to phase it out. But this is probably going to lead now to a renewal of that dependency. Okay, well, let me conclude. Putin now has a strong hand, and I think he's just coming to recognize and appreciate just how strong it is, just like Saudi Arabia has a strong hand. Assuming, of course, he doesn't overplay it prematurely. and he's beginning to see this now and appreciate it, so that at this January 31st press conference that I mentioned to you, he was asked, what do you think when you hear Americans, Congressman Lantos and Senator McCain saying, throw Russia out of the G8, don't let them in? And that's where Putin's response was, the dog barks, but the caravan moves on. Now, that turns out to be an old Arabic saying, you know, and given the fact that Saudi Arabia controls all the oil, it's perfectly appropriate for Putin to say this. What did he mean by that? The dog barks, the caravan's coming, the camels are coming. The dog barks, but who the hell cares? And we're going to do what we want to do. We're moving on, let the dog bark. Yap, yap, yap if you want. If you throw us out of the G8, it doesn't matter. We're strong enough now to do exactly what we want to do. And I would argue, as I mentioned, I hinted at the beginning of the talk, that right now Russia is stronger than it's ever been. In the Soviet period, there was, you know, Russia was a superpower. It's not quite yet a superpower, but it has power that you don't have to have, even if you're a superpower, because we think of that militarily. It was during the Cold War, Russia was strong. It was a superpower, but there was another superpower, and that was the United States, and we balanced off each other. It was called mutually assured destruction. We won't send our missiles to them because we know they'll send their missiles to us. And they won't send their missiles to us because we know we'll send their missiles to them. So it was a standoff. With oil, there's no standoff. And gas, there's no standoff because they've got it. The dog barks. The caravan moves on. And if you don't like it, kids, you know what you can do. Well, and the monopoly that's there with the pipeline gives them this enormous strength. And so I'll end then with a joke that, it's not a joke, but it gives us the sense of Putin's power and his realization that he can do just as he damn well pleases. First of all, Putin is notorious for his use of prison argot, slang, criminal slang from the street. So it's crude, this is Wellesley after all, who cares? So after his inauguration as president, Putin goes to the Kremlin for the first time, sees an aide standing there and calls him over. He says, "Where can I piss?" And the aide says, "Now, any place you want." Well, in a sense, Putin can piss anywhere he wants, given the fact that he's got this resource and that he can do as he pleases. So there we are. So if anybody has any questions. Yeah?
I wonder if you could say a bit about Putin's relationship with the armed forces in Russia, and to what extent is there a renewal process going on that's sort of concomitant with these other situations?
Yeah, what about Putin's relationship with the armed forces? I just saw today that they're increasing military expenditures for purchases, military equipment, by 40%. Well, Putin is putting, just as the Chinese are putting, a disproportionate share of the increased GDP into the military. Now, the problem is that given what's going on in Chechnya, the military is in a state of chaos. They've just had this terrible scandal which has jeopardized Putin's close buddy, who's the Minister of Defense, Sergei Ivanov. The Russians have this practice of hazing their recruits, the draftees, And this young man, Christmas, was harassed, beaten up by the sergeants, as it were, the corporals, the people who were not privates. And he was beaten. He was left in the cold. They had to amputate his legs and his genitals. And there's been a mother's group which has been protesting the brutality of this. And this is just terrible. Because initially the officers said, well, there was nothing wrong. You know, this is just boys being boys. But this guy, almost near death. And it's kind of reflected the terrible morale problem that exists there. So the army right now does not command respect, nowhere near, of course, what it did before. Military officers will tell you they won't wear their uniforms in public, which was just never the case in the Soviet period. Everybody wore a uniform. But Putin is trying to revitalize it, and he makes these, you know, with technology, recognizing that American technology in particular, militarily, is really very advanced, and he's trying to do what he can to build it up. So this is an attempt to reconstitute it. He wants to be a superpower, but he also recognizes, and he said, we can't do anything until we build up our economy, and that's why he wants to double it in 10 years.
I see that America doesn't use a lot of oil from Russia, but we used to worry about tungsten and chromium.
Yeah, and platinum and palladium. Those are raw materials that are very important, and you know, except for South Africa, the precious metals, as it were, Russia is the major supplier of that. In addition to which, we haven't focused on it as a country, which I take in some sense as a positive sign. It means it's normal that when countries come and buy up our resources, but Norilsk Nickel, which is owned by one of the oligarchs, has just bought up the one producer of platinum and palladium, and I think it's in Montana, just bought it up as a subsidiary. And I say it's normal because, you know, we're not making a fuss, although we would be making a fuss with the Dubai ports. And the Russians actually bought up quite a lot. Getty Oil is now owned by a Russian oil company. The River Rouge steel plant is now owned by Russian steel maker. So the Russians are beginning to buy up our companies. And if you've got, you know, if we're running a trade deficit, we're not saving. They take the money and they're entitled to buy it. And at this point, I don't view it as a major threat. But down the road, it might catch people's attention. But anyway, so far, we are jeopardized by that. But down the road, it might be. Yep. Is Russia safe for international investment? I personally would never invest, but that's partly because I work on the area, and I don't think that you should invest in what you're working on because then you got a conflict of interest. And as a result, the Russian stock market last year was one of the world's highest performing stock markets. But I've just seen figures which indicate that 90% of the investment in the Russian stock market comes from a very few number of foreign investors, not Russian investors. The Russians themselves send their money outside the country, or have been doing that at least until last year, this big capital outflow. I think there are safer things to invest in, and maybe the yield would not be as high, but there's less danger. In 1998, there were a couple of books that were written by some of my friends with whom I'd had major arguments. They were criticizing me for being always such a pessimist. I mean, you wouldn't get that idea tonight, but and I was always criticizing them for being just woolly. So one of them wrote a book, The Coming Russian Boom. He wrote in 1997. And of course, there was that crash which wiped everybody out. And affected our stock market, bringing it down by 20% in 1998. So, right now, Russia has a trade surplus. It has building up capital reserves. So it's very unlikely that they will default on their debt. Now they don't have that much. But I just don't feel comfortable with it. And There are, again, the mutual funds that provide you with an investment in Russia have done very well. The Harvard Management Corporation did very well. I don't know all that much about Wellesley's portfolio now, but I would be surprised if we don't have some investment there too. Gazprom, for example. You know, if you bought Gazprom last year, you would have maybe increased your investment tenfold in a short period of time. So that's my own problem. Phil?
Two questions. One, you made reference to the use of gas, and I think it's principally gas in Armenia and in Georgia.
Right.
If my memory serves me correctly, it was also last winter, about the same time they were blocking Ukraine, that there was an accident, and all of a sudden Georgia was
frozen.
Energy. Was that an accident, or was that a political?
The Georgians say it was no accident. The Russians say it was an accident. Gas pipelines are particularly in Russia, are poorly maintained, and there are periodic explosions that take place elsewhere within Russia proper. I don't know personally, but it certainly was a way of signaling to the Georgians that they're looking for trouble, and they continued to cause problems for the Russians, because it's not only a gas pipeline, but there's also an oil pipeline that comes from the Caspian that the Russians want to get a hold of, and we don't want them. So there's really a confrontation there. You know, the great game, as it was played in the 19th century, between Britain and Tsarist Russia as to who was going to control Afghanistan and Central Asia. Well, there's a new, and oil in that region, there's a new great game. We're playing it with the Russians. It's the United States versus the Russian in the Caspian Sea and in Georgia, and the Russians say, you're coming in our backyard. So,
the second question was concerning your table 2 that shows the precipitous decline in energy production in the with the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And then it's a very sharp rise after 1998.
Yeah.
And my question is just 1990s statistics. Is that all the Soviet Union?
Only Russia.
Only Russia.
Russia. It's consistent for Russia. That's why I don't have some of the figures here for gas. I mean, but this is it's only the Russian thing. Akila?
The last couple of days there have been pieces, Seymour Hersh piece saying that the United States is thinking about bombing Iran.
Yeah.
I was curious what you think the Russian response to such an.
Well, Iran has been a major customer of Russia. Of course, it's on the border. It's no longer on the border. I mean, it used to be on the border until the country broke up because there's Azerbaijan, and so now there's some difference. But they are the two major sides on the Caspian Sea, which also, of course, now involves Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan. It's too bad I don't have a map of that. But so the Russians are the ones who have been supplying them the nuclear reactor that is at risk. We have been arguing in the United States that we hope that the Russians will lean on the Iranians and offer Iran reprocessing of nuclear fuel in Russia through one of the Russian plants so that the Iranians won't do it, because that can be used for munitions. First of all, any unilateral action by the United States drives the Russians crazy. Besides which, it's so close to them that, one of the things, I heard Seymour Hersh tonight on All Things Considered, and he was saying what the talk is of using nuclear weapons, tactical weapons to do that, which of course would drive the Russians crazy as well. So they're not happy about it. But at the same time, again, this is name dropping, but there's an article in one of the Russian papers today in which I'm quoted as saying this is a great chance for the Russians to show that they can negotiate with the Iranians and get them to back off. Of course, you can say it, but as if the Iranians we'll just do whatever the Russians want. But the point is that if they could do this, then this would really show that Putin is someone who the West should applaud as a peacemaker, Nobel Prize, all this kind of stuff. But in the meantime, the Russians are just going to be, you know, very upset. What they have done is Ivanov, the Minister of Defense, has just adopted a policy which says that Russia can have a first strike as well. If the United States can act unilaterally and have a first strike, we Russians can do the same thing. God spare us. But that's inevitably, you know, if George Bush says we're going to do this, he has to expect others are going to say the same thing. So this would cause great grief. Yasushi?
The Russian companies, Siroviki owned,
yeah.
You listed in Table 4. Are there any American or European capitals invested in those or none at all?
Yeah, the question is, what about some...
Secondly, can they compete? Can Sukhoi or MiG compete with F-16 or Tupolev Ilyushin compete with Boeing? How they compete?
Yeah. It has to, the two questions have to do with these companies that the Russian are taking back. It's a very interesting situation. Gazprom, they're welcoming investment. As long as the Russians control 51%, the idea is give us all the money you want. Put all the money you want in here. Just don't ask any questions. Another example is ConocoPhillips has been investing in Lukoil, and Lukoil, which is privately owned, but Putin has said you can invest up to 20% in Lukoil, but you can't do more than that. So give us all the money, give us all the technology, but don't you have no ownership in the sense of determining what the company will do. So, you know, it's just give us your money and go home. I think that's a pretty wild thing. If you want management control, so you're going to put your money in and you're at their mercy. The Russian companies have been generating enormous debt. The state is paying off its debt, but Gazprom has borne an enormous debt because it bought Sibneft. Rosneft has bought up an enormous debt because it brought up Yugansneftogaz, and they have to go out and borrow money on this kind of thing. And the question is, what are they doing with the money they're going to borrow? Well, some of it's to pay back the debt, some of it's just to put it in their own pockets to create new oligarchs, as it were. What about how competitive the military aircraft are? Some of them are quite competitive. Some of the advanced MiGs will outmaneuver American jets. But at the same time, again, this is a crazy world. United Technologies, which is, you know, Hartford, is working with the Russian aircraft manufacturers to provide them with engines, you know, to make them more energy efficient. Boeing is doing the same thing. Boeing is also, of course, hiring large numbers. They have, I think, maybe 2,000, maybe overstating it, about 2,000 Russian engineers designing this new airplane, the 787 that Boeing is going to build, which is this real new superliner. Which will use new, what's the word, not plastics, but carbon things that, and also be very energy efficient, 20% more energy efficient than anything that Airbus has. So at this point, the Russian aircraft industry is in deep, dire straits. I think last year they sold maybe 4 new Russian-made aircraft, passenger aircraft. Boeing is trying to design for them a much smaller plane, you know, that will fly maybe to compete with the Brazilian plane. But that wouldn't compete directly with Boeing. But right now they're not so good. Okay, one last question. What difference does it make for the ordinary Russian citizen? That's probably one of the saddest parts of it. The whole privatization process, the Russians got a voucher worth 10,000 rubles, which by the time it was through was the equivalent of about $35. Almost every Russian, and Poland, by contrast, in Poland, there was an ongoing relationship in that the state ended up with the stock of any company that was being privatized. So that whenever a company declared a dividend, it went into the pension fund for the Poles generally. Nothing like that in Russia. And in fact, In the early years, until the late 90s at the best, Gazprom was not paying any dividends. They weren't paying their taxes. So the state benefited hardly at all, which meant that the ordinary citizen benefited hardly at all. I mean, do you own any stock in Gazprom? You know, so you know, when I said, you know, this Russian stock market, to the extent that 90% of the stock that's held in the Russian stock market is held by foreigners, is again a reflection that the ordinary Russian did not benefit from this. And that's why there's such anger about the oligarchs. When Khodorkovsky was arrested, almost nobody cared. A good, you know, good riddance to bad rubbish, which is what I used to say. Well, employment, this is the paradox. And it's, again, my wife asks me, how can there be such wealth in Russia when it's only in energy, it's not in manufacturing? And it's a mystery, because if, you know, when you go to Moscow and you find these enormous traffic jams, or even happening now in St. Petersburg, not as much, and the stores are filled with luxury goods. Of course, once you get outside Moscow in the countryside, it's like falling off a cliff, but even there, it's getting better. So some of it trickles down, and if you look at disposable income, real disposable income, that's going up significantly, almost 12% a year. So somehow, it's, you know, which is faster than the GDP is growing. But they don't, you know, there are not many people required to work producing, pumping the oil out of the ground or the natural gas out of the ground. There's very little processing. Refineries are not, you know, there are relatively few refineries even in Russia. So the ordinary worker doesn't get it. And for a long time, of course, the petroleum industry also was delinquent in paying wages. So, you know, there was this terrible problem. People weren't paid their wages for as much as 9, 10, 12 months. That seems to be less of a problem today. But for the workers generally, it's not so good. But you see consumers. You had another question. Go ahead. Yeah.
But do you think the company, government really, and the country really succeed when the regular citizens are not really benefiting from the money?
Yeah. No, that's a good question. As you know, if the ordinary Russian is not benefiting, what's there? Well, I think what is happening is what. Well, here's one way, another way of measuring it. In 1998, over 30%, 33% of the population was below the poverty line. How you define the poverty line, of course, it's a moving target, but a third of the population was below the poverty line. Putin, to his credit, I say Putin is not my hero, but to his credit, Putin worried about this, and he said, that's why I want the GDP to grow. And for a Russian leader, I thought it was incredibly candid of him to say, our GDP per capita is below that of Portugal, which was the poorest country of the European Union at the time. And we've got to do better than that. And it's going to take us a long time to accomplish that. So, but he also recognized that to the extent that the GDP grows 6-7% a year, it's going to lift everybody up. So that today, less than 20% of the population is below the poverty line, something like 18%. And so somehow or other, some of that benefit is going to some of the Russians, not proportionally. I mean, there's the disparity between the percentage of the GDP of the wealth owned or the income generated by the richest 10% vastly exceeds what goes on with the lower 10%. According to some estimates, more than in the United States, where you know we have our problem as well. So, but you know, to the extent that you get people above the poverty line. And this is one of Putin's, you know, stated goals, and more credit to him. That I take to be better than it was 10 years ago. I think that's one way of looking at it. So it's nothing to celebrate, but it's certainly, I think it's getting better. I don't. How do you feel?
I just that
Look it up. Did you all hear what she had to say? You know, to what extent are the statistics, can you believe the statistics? Because she recites the case of her grandparents who live on something like $100 a month. For the elderly, for the retirees, it's always been hard. It's been very hard. And inflation grows faster. January 2005, you had the elderly really demonstrating, going out on the street, in a way that the Russians was atypical. It hadn't demonstrated like this, I think, since the 1980s, where just kind of unprovoked, no organized campaign, people just went out, because in part they were telling them that they were no longer entitled to certain fringe benefits, in-kind benefits, free transportation, medical, housing, things of this sort. And so you got the elderly going out there on the street, blocking traffic, doing things. But while the statistics probably leave a lot to be desired, my general impression is that the number who are caught like that is diminishing. I don't want to say for a second that happy days are here again, but you see, even when I go out into the countryside now, I tend to go back to the same places year after year. I do see some improvement out in the provinces. Now, this August, I'll be going on the Trans-Siberian Railroad again. That'll give me a better feel for the interior, when last time I was there, it was 97. It was bad, and I actually wrote an article predicting the 98 collapse because I just said this was just unsustainable. But again, just the number of cars that are there, that my friends who never dreamed of having a car, who now have an automobile, who travel, for God's sakes, going to Paris, it's filtering down to more, not to the elderly, not to the very poor who will still be begging in ways that you never saw before. But I think overall, it may, go ahead. Yeah. Well, I on the whole, I'm opposed. I mean, this is largely because I'm upset by what the political retreat and his turning it over to his buddies. But at the same time, I mean, he has, just the fact that the GDP is growing. What I want to say is that if I were the president, it would still grow, simply because oil prices are high. You don't need talent for that. But for the Russian people love him. He gets 70% rating, public opinion polls. Maybe not the grandparents, and the Communist Party is still there. But for the most part, the young people in Russia, at least the ones I meet, accept the new way and think that they can benefit from it. Not everybody, but I think Russia. It's the problem is, see, in the aftermath of Yeltsin, you needed somebody who was going to consolidate things. And he did it. I would have been much happier if he'd only had one term. Because it's the second term of his presidency, beginning in 2004, where he's taken all these moves, which I think have really created a backward step. I see more and more signs of what I remember as of the Soviet Union, which is really very dismal. So, okay.
So, the Russian economy may not be much to celebrate, but Marshall Goldman is. So.